top of the news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
You will die only to live again in a younger body. Then you can tell me if the operation was a success. I could easily kill you now, but I'm determined to have your brain.
You're listening to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of genre cinema. Hi, my name is Chris, and along with Jeff, we talk about movies that aren't really awful at all. Horror, action, kung fu, musicals, post-apocalyptic, women in prison films, and much, much more.
From our downtown Toronto headquarters, here's episode 352 of the Really Awful Movies Podcast. The series currently on Netflix, Mindhunter. Now, I've made no bones about the fact that I'm pretty obsessed with police procedural type programming, and I'm quite a big fan of true crime, and that whether it's podcasts or nonfiction books, and it's informed by some of my reading growing up, particularly a local Toronto Sun reporter who would cover, I mean, obviously the local crime beat. And his name is Max Haynes, and his books or his crime columns and news reportage would be converted into a series of different books. And Jeff and I also took part in a Jack the Ripper tour when the two of us were in London in the Whitechapel neighborhood. So it's something I've always been keenly interested in. And this show, Mindhunter, is part of a wave and a proliferation of true crime, sort of FBI profiling type shows in the vein of the, I think, since recently canceled Criminal Minds, but the spate of different offerings, whether it's Law & Order SVU or one of the myriad choices you have available. Of course, the difference being with this effort is it's an actual, I mean, it's a very high quality production. David Fincher, who directed quite a few episodes and who was the de facto showrunner for the series, and obviously is best known for his iconic films such as Seven and whatnot. I mean, I don't know to what extent people are a fan of Zodiac. I didn't quite warm to it, but I mean, his movies are pretty great, whether it's Fight Club. Jeff texted me to inform me that he fell asleep during The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, but my point largely stands in that Fincher's aesthetic sensibilities are perfectly married to this kind of production. And you know, Mindhunter, of all things, my viewing thereof is actually informed by local Torontonian and writer and journalist, much like myself, a graduate of the University of Toronto, Malcolm Gladwell. Now he's based in New York, but he of the shock of his hair that stands straight on end, and he looks like he's perpetually electrocuted. He's kind of an interesting guy, and has a book called Talking to Strangers. And given that I have a lifelong interest in personality psychology and people's idiosyncratic behaviors, the whole thrust of the book, Talking to Strangers, is how you can sort of make informed and sometimes uninformed, hasty judgments of people, and how you can learn a lot, well, by talking to people and different kinds of interactions and how they can go awry. This is at the heart of all these kind of procedurals, where there's just interactions between suspects, or as they use unsub or unidentified suspect as the lingo here. And it's all centered around the nascent at the time, and this is a period piece, FBI profiling unit and criminal behavior unit. And it's pretty funny that there was a time before which behavioral profiles and personality tests were not even part of the lexicon or the arsenal of a modern day police force. So you'd actually have to have be basically flying blind and not have your investigations informed by any psychological research or behavioral profiling. It's amazing when you think about it, but policing is just like any other field in that apologies, there's a the renovations going on in my apartment building here, but policing is just like any other field. It adapts and grows, and technology informs it by leaps and bounds. So obviously, when policing really, modern policing anyway, really came to the fore around maybe the 1890s in the aforementioned London in the UK, there have really been a bunch of structural and developmental advancements that have really affected how policing is done, particularly as it pertains to serial killers, which is the focus of Mindhunters. And incorporating, I guess, some of the more famous serial killers from the 70s and 80s, whether it's Richard Speck, the notorious Illinois nurse murderer, or Edmund Kemper, the hulking, sadistic brute who murdered various women. I believe he was something like 6'8 or 6'9. He was just a terrifying and amoral, just deviant, lunatic type figure. But Gladwell, getting back to him, he made an appearance on the Joe Rogan show, and he said that he was a big fan of these kinds of procedural things, and he divided them in a pretty neat kind of way, and you can check it out for yourself on YouTube. But he really subdivided these into four different categories: a Western, an Eastern, a Northern, and a Southern. Now, everyone in the knows anything about the history of film. Obviously, in the 40s and 50s and 60s, the Western was the pinnacle of Hollywood box office draw, and you had John Wayne and these types of films that were really capturing the public's imagination. And then furthermore, when Italy reflected these back to us in the form of spaghetti Western and your Clint Eastwood and that. So similarly, that takes place in a world where there's no law and order, and a man shows up, usually some mysterious stranger, like a sheriff, and imposes law and order on a territory or the community. And you can see this in the series Deadwood, where Timothy Oliphant plays that very figure. So there's in Deadwood, in the Dakotas, there it's a mining town, and there it's in the midst of a gold rush, and there's no law and order to be had. Now, Gladwell also distinguishes an Eastern, in which there's law and order and institutions of justice that are pretty efficacious, but they have been subverted by people from within, sort of like the cliche of the corrupt cop in popular culture. There's also the Northern, where law and order exists and is morally righteous and really is continually efficacious. I mean, you see this in countless episodes of Law & Order SVU, where you have the show structure being like a red herring thrust at you in the first 5 minutes. That's very obvious, typically in the form of a creepy sort of middle-aged paunchy janitor, and it's never that person. It's just a decoy, and then they move on. But there's always a satisfying, or predominantly a satisfying, conclusion at the end of every Law & Order SVU. The system is pretty much perfect with a few hiccups along the way. And you have the likes of Ice-T glowering at you for a full hour. So a Southern, by contrast, is where the entire apparatus has gone to shit, and the reformer is not an insider but an outsider who comes in and makes things right. And I think he cites John Grisham novels. I've not read one in a long time, but I know they made numerous Grisham novels into made film adaptations of those novels. So this is a roundabout way of getting to Mindhunter, the TV series, and what informed my watching of it. And there's an associated book that I'd love to get my hands on as well while we're on the subject of reading materials, called Mindhunter: Inside the FBI's Elite Serial Crime Unit by John Douglas and Mark Olshaker. And I can't comment now as to the extent to which they got this right, but you have a cast of characters that makes up or comprises this nascent FBI unit from the 70s. And what's so great about Mindhunter as a series is it's so cinematic, and as well it should be when you have Fincher's aesthetic sensibilities brought to the fore, because each episode is so wonderfully self-contained, but also has like a certain darkness and a certain sense of foreboding that Fincher really brings to bear in the really exceptional Seven, which got better with my third viewing of it recently, and it is such a just an incredibly well-made movie, and it makes you really appreciate the far-reaching influence that show had on that movie had on TV shows, which I think are in many cases inferior copies of it. And it's just the two leads are just so charming, and it's such an incredible film. But he brings that. He's one of the producers, along with, of all people, Charlize Theron. So you have this heavy-duty cinematic sensibility, and you have these three characters who are really struggling to really put their stamp on this new unit, which is Behavioral Sciences Unit. And it's something that's kind of about which other members of the FBI are very dismissive. And because feel that their work is about catching the bad guys and really punishing them, but it's not really informed by the kind of data that we've come to now know and expect. I mean, there's a researcher out of UBC, the University of British Columbia in Western Canada, named Dr. Robert Hare, that's H-A-R-E, whose psychopathy checklist is a commonly used metric for determining how, sociopathic or someone's sociopathic or psychopathic tendencies. And it's funny because, well, what's great actually about Mindhunter is the fact that as the program of behavioral sciences is developing within the FBI, as is the principal's comfort with it and their expertise. So you get very green gumshoes, or very green detectives who really don't know what they're doing. And as they amass more data, they put it to good use and use it to actually assist small local law enforcement who don't have the resources of like a big city like a New York or Chicago to really investigate these things properly. But you get these FBI principals who are learning as they go and learning on the job. And what's really, really fascinating about this series too is not only how they were so offhandedly dismissed, but also the very subtle ways in which the 70s time period is called to life. So it doesn't smack you over the head with this is the 70s in the way that Almost Famous does, or maybe the TV series That 70s Show, where everyone's sporting bell bottoms and a shoddy haircut and everyone's just bedecked in oranges and browns and everything. It's more subtle, it's more realistic of the time, and it also brings to bear some of the subtle, gender imbalances and disparities that would have plagued the FBI at the time, and who knows, perhaps still does, where in the, today's recording session is just beset with sort of technical problems here. We got this bloody beeping horn, and then the reno isn't happening. But they allude to the different FBI freshmen, I guess, if you want to call them that, the underclassmen, and they are largely men, and they have like a subtle nod to the fact that women were not really consulted much in the early days of FBI behavior profiling, which is ridiculous, because when you figure that their interactions with predators, who are predominantly men with few exceptions, would have been really integral, and especially liaising with maybe victims who might have initially charmed by the perps. So it would have been essential to have a women's viewpoint on a team. So you have these three characters. You have the young upstart, who's a Holden Ford. Holden, obviously the character from Catcher in the Rye, Holden Caulfield, but his partner is the square-jawed Bill Tench. And he's the sort of do-it-by-the-book kind of guy who's along for the ride, but a really good cop and a stern-faced. And they team up with a Boston psychologist, Wendy Carr, who is a queer woman who's doing research in the country's northeast, and who the aforementioned two male detectives convince to abandon her cushy university post and come join them at Quantico at the FBI's Academy in Virginia. And together they source a bunch of research dollars and investment funding for the very early nascent days of criminal psychology. And it's something that it's just fascinating to see how this played out, and how, in regardless of the organization, there's always landmines to be avoided and impropriety that you could encounter. In the case Mindhunter, in the first season at least, the only one I've seen, they run into problems where they what they call scope creep, where they take on cases that are maybe beyond the initial mandate of the FBI to really cover. So in one case, impropriety involving a local school principal, and one of the characters, Holden Ford, gets too involved in the case when he thinks that the principal's being way too touchy-feely. So there's instances like that, and also how these kinds of organizations are internally policed and investigated is very interesting, because Holden Ford gets too close to his subjects in a way that a lot of, I think, criminal profilers would probably have to. Or let's say law enforcement who go undercover to infiltrate the likes of, I don't know, the Bandidos or the Hells Angels or something. You get too, or for the mafia or whatever, you get too close to it and you become too drawn to these sort of psychopathic callous, coarse characters you're compelled to hang around with, or in the case of Mindhunter, talk to every day. And detectives Ford and Tench, their entire funding for the research project is predicated on a series of standardized questions, which is going to form a report and make up a bunch of behavioral recommendations for how to capture serial killers. And they are involved in a seemingly very difficult task of going to go across the country to different regions, whether it's Oregon, or whether it's Kansas, where the BTK bind, torture, kill Dennis Rader killer resided and plied his grisly trade. Basically, going all over the country to interview different serial killers to find out what makes them tick. So you have just this a fascinating dynamic between these three very different people. I mean, a queer woman from the Northeast who's just a stern, buttoned-down, grim-faced academic who doesn't crack a smile, is wholly invested in a kind of publisher-parish academic mindset, and then a young upstart, Holden Ford, who's maybe 28 years old and trying to establish himself among the ranks of the FBI at the Academy, and whose expertise is derived largely from hostage negotiations. And then, of course, you have Bill Tench, who's a middle-aged, heavy drinker, who's more the traditional archetypal police guy, the grizzled, seen-it-all type guy. But the dynamic between them, not to mention their overseer and their boss, is just so terrifically played and so incredibly compelling and so interesting that you can't help but be totally and wholly engaged and captivated by this show, or at least I was. So there are two seasons of this. It's filmed in Pennsylvania in some really, really great, like, Rust Belt sort of not exactly thriving towns that really add to this atmosphere as well. And the cases and the performances, especially those of the real life murderers that they encounter, are just so chilling and captivating that, I mean, especially the Edmund Kemper, so this is played by Cameron Britton as the notorious serial killer there, but it's just everyone is so on point and everything is so well handled. There's also a love interest of Holden Ford, a girlfriend who's played by a Toronto actress named Hannah Gross. And she's the daughter of a famous Canadian actor named Paul Gross, who's in Due South, like an RCMP Mountie type show that I think aired in the States. But she's such an interesting character because their dynamic, her relationship with the young FBI agent, is flipped on its head for what you would normally expect. So this, expectations are completely flipped, because she's sort of the cold, calculating academic one, and young Holden Ford is more like a fly off the handle, and they're just very, very different characters, and yet they come together over their mutual appreciation for all the intricacies and subtleties of human behavior. I mean, she's a PhD student in sociology, which is an adjacent field to psychology, obviously, and Holden Ford is taking upgrade courses at the University of Virginia to really bone up on his personality psychology and really help him get a better handle on all the deviates he's tasked to interview. So I think season two is going to feature the likes of David Berkowitz, the son of Sam, the postal worker whose dog allegedly spoke to him, and others. I think Charlie Manson may make an appearance as well. But so far, so good. Really, really just dynamite use of just locales. Fascinating subject matter for sure, and top drawer performances across the board, and it's something that it's well worth checking out. And it's just another thing, I mean, it's a lot like Better Call Saul. It's going to be another instance where I just got to sit around and wait for the upcoming season with kind of bated breath, but I'm trying to go through it as best I can, limiting myself to maybe one episode or even a half an episode a night. And uniquely, they run the gamut from like an hour and 15 to like 36 minute episodes, and it doesn't have that standardized kind of Netflix sensibility that I've grown accustomed to. So this was something that I found really, really, damn these bloody car alarms. Speaking of security and behavior, but I guess I'm going to draw things to a close and maybe mention a few things I've learned. Well, again, I've learned that this is a very, very cinematic production with great visuals. You got Cameron Britton who plays Edmund Kemper in Mindhunter, who's I think he was Emmy nominated for his performance. He's just so intense. I'm not really familiar with anything else he's done, but he's someone to watch, a guy in his 30s who just envelops the role so wholly and so totally. There's also a scene in rural Georgia. There's a murder in rural Georgia that takes place of a cheerleader, a majorette, I believe, and the interrogation techniques that the FBI deploys, very controversial, is something that's very, very fascinating to watch, and it was amazing to see. Like, if you compare it to the real interrogations that you might like, I urge listeners to check out the one involving cross-dresser and notorious rapist and murderer Colonel Russell Williams of the Canadian Armed Forces. His interrogation was something very, very intense to behold, and he's just one of the real lowlifes that my country has ever produced, and it's amazing to see how close he got to the powers that be. Even at one point, I think he was a high-class pilot, and I believe he piloted Queen Elizabeth to some event somewhere. So he hobnobbed with a lot of politicos north of the border. So that was a particularly fascinating case, but that's worth checking out. But this whole series is just something really, really very, very well done, very top drawer, and it's something that that Fincher really acquits himself for. I mean, of course he would. I mean, it's David Fincher, right? I mean, even stuff that he does that's not so hot, I think is pretty good. I mean, the girl with the dragon tattoo, I caught midway, and not knowing anything about the books, I just was like hooked right away. And there's something about his films that, I don't know what it is, but it's just something so, something that just draws you in. I mean, The Social Network has to be one of the best films of the early 2000s as well. Just very, very, very tautly scripted and just brilliantly acted. And I think a few hiccups in terms of attention to some factual details, but damn good stuff. And you will really enjoy Mindhunter. I'm going to have to cut this one short because This is just not my day here with that car alarm, but I hope to chat with everyone soon, and I'm going to be getting back to some 70s and 80s horror. And hopefully everyone continues to listen, pick up a copy of our book, Death by Umbrella, and also Mine's Bigger Than Yours, our homage to 80s action films, and we shall talk to you soon. Take care. Thank you.